Hello and welcome to DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. On today's show, Comme des Garçons has opened for a year in downtown LA. Meanwhile, New York storefront for art and architecture will touch down for 5 weeks on Sunset. We'll look at pop-up commerce and culture later on the show. Plus, an attack on the front lawn. But first, design on show in LA. A few years ago, an entrepreneur named Charles Trotter decided that LA needed a showcase for its booming modern design market. He's a very tenacious guy and badgered and cajoled designers and architects into being part of a trade fair he called Kaboom. This weekend, Kaboom held its fifth show at Barker Hangar at Santa Monica Airport. Wind was buffeting through the hangar, but thousands came to see the latest in products, furnishing, prefab building materials, and cool design for kids. And many agree that it was the smartest show so far. Kimberly Stevens writes for the New York Times and the Architects newspaper. I asked her what caught her attention at the show.
Actually, you know what? There is one thing that I loved. It was a fiber cement planter. It was green, very lightweight, and they come in all different shapes. And there's a planter that's in the shape of a man. It looks like a paper doll. And it's just a fabulous design, really fun, great for a rooftop, great for the backyard. And I loved it. It was one of the standouts for me. I was interested in the real trend of the studio furniture makers. Really custom, beautifully designed, handmade, modern pieces using recycled woods, indigenous woods. I thought that was one of the interesting sort of high points.
Now, the market is kind of tough at the moment. Did you get a sense of how this is kind of playing out for the designers here?
You know, no one really expressed a lot of concern. I thought the most interesting commentary came from the building section because a lot of the products are sustainable and green. And, you know, even though the economy is suffering at the moment, they all talked about the growth in that particular market.
Now, there's always been a slightly bohemian sort of quality to Kaboom compared to other trade shows. Would you say that's true, and would you say that it's still there? It's got a kind of ever so slightly chaotic quality, but that's sort of what makes it fun.
I definitely think I noticed it far more in the beginning. It seems to be sort of pulling together aesthetically, and I think a lot of the initial people that may have showed the first, you know, year or so are no longer with the show. I think they've become a little bit more competitive about who they're allowing to showcase. But that being said, there are still, you know, some really interesting sort of funky products. There's a great sustainable pet, you know, doghouse company that has just a very funky feel. That's the kind of thing that's surprising, I think, in a good way.
That was the design writer, Kimberly Stevens. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. Kaboom may be a new name in the design world. One of the oldest is the glossy shelter magazine Architectural Digest. For many interior designers and architects, AD, as it's often called, is the place to be published. But it's hard to get projects accepted. But now a crack is opening in the door. On the 26th and 27th of this month, AD will hold all-day open auditions at the Pacific Design Center to find new talent. Hopefuls must bring a project that meets the following conditions: new, completed, unpublished, and not for sale. Margaret Dunn is Executive Director of Architectural Digest. She says that when they held these call-outs previously, people came from all over the world.
Oh, yes. And we actually had a couple who were from the Midwest that drove to New York. And then when we were in Fort Lauderdale 2 months later, they came there, too, to show us something else. Because they just, it's such an exciting experience for people because they never knew that they could do this. It kind of leads to how did our editor-in-chief come up with this idea. And it was because she had heard so many times people saying, oh, my work will never be published because I don't know anybody, or I thought I had to pay to be in the magazine. And so she put out in her editor's letter a call to people saying, that's simply not true. If you don't want to just send it in, we're going to come to you.
I mean, AD does have a reputation for being elite and very difficult to get one's work into.
Right. Well, part of that's because We get probably over 2,000 submissions a year. We can only feature about 18 homes a month. And of those months, we have special issues in there. So it's even smaller amount that we can feature.
And I think it's fair to say that like all the architecture publications or design publications, there are certain kind of star designers out there that the editors will seek out. So there's certain designers who, even before a project's been finished, they know they're going to get it in Digest. Whereas Mr. Nobody from Kansas, you know, doesn't have that advantage by any stretch.
Right. And a lot has to do, and this is Paige Rentz's philosophy, is it has to be good. And over time, you get better and better. And the more experience you have, the more talented you're going to become. And then your work will be published.
Now, is it interiors or exteriors that you're looking for?
Well, we're looking for the whole thing. So if someone wants to come, we ask that they bring two pictures of each of the major rooms. And the major rooms are the living room, the dining room, the master bedroom, a kitchen, and then an exterior or two if they have it, to put the whole package together. And we ask that they be photographs, not on discs or on the computer, because we just can't look at them that way.
So you want prints?
Yes.
And do people have to go and hire an expensive photographer?
No, great question. They don't, because we're going to go back and photograph it if we select it to go into the magazine.
And do people have to be licensed interior designers or architects?
No, not at all. It just has to be good design. That's what we're looking for.
Now, is this going to be like American Idol? Is there going to be a jury of you that, and some poor person shows their project and one of you screams out rude remarks, you know, while another of you tries to make them feel better?
Well, we kind of wondered if we were like that. But because none of us can see everything at the same time, we're accepting everything. So when someone brings us their project, just so they know, it's going to be accepted for review. And then a day after, we sit down with Paige, our editor-in-chief, because she's the final decision-maker. She sees everything. But it is a collective jury. We all weigh in, and there's probably five of us.
And people just show up on the day. They don't need to apply in advance or anything like that.
We are asking, just so we kind of have an idea of how many people to expect, that they RSVP, let us know they're coming, on our website, www.architecturaldigest.com.
Margaret Dunn, Executive Editor of Architectural Digest. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I hope everyone will come at the end of March.
Architectural Digest's open audition will take place on the 26th and 27th of March at the Pacific Design Center. See our website for more details. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. Coming up, a designer attacks a sacrosanct American space, the front lawn. But first, pop-up culture and commerce. The avant-garde Japanese fashion house Comme des Garçons, founded by Rei Kawakubo, has flagship stores in Tokyo, Paris, and New York. But the firm also sells its clothes through what it calls guerrilla stores, temporary stores that touch down in offbeat locations for 1 year. Now, one has just opened in downtown Los Angeles. It's tucked away off an alley near 4th and Spring, near both Skid Row and the pricey lofts of the revamped historic district. The store is co-owned by Brett Westfall and Tak Kato. Tak designed and built the interior with hand-chipped tile on the walls and a tower of shopping trolleys that echoes the punk meets high art quality of the clothes. I asked Tak and Brett, why there?
It has to be a historical building. It cannot be a commercial area. Has to be a unique place.
Can't be anywhere where there's an existing Comme des Garçons store.
And what exactly is the point of the guerrilla aspect of the store?
It's just using, non-regular way of going about, the retail. I guess, the tactics that they use in order to, the guerrilla marketing, not putting a big budget into, the marketing of the space or anything like that, just, word of mouth and posters and things like that.
The concept is that it's temporary, but what if the store turns out to be a great big success? Would you stay?
It's possible, extension or change locations.
Because the idea is that it's not meant to turn into a permanent store.
Exactly. So you just keep it moving.
it's very, very different from like 10, 20 years ago. Before, you have to go to the retail shop to buy something. But now you can buy on, you know, you can even, you don't even have to go to the store to buy something. But for like something like this, Comme des Garçons, I'd like to people come and take a look why she's so great, why so very, very important, most important designer in the century. I just wanna feel the customer. They don't even have to buy, just come and feel it, you know, and then understand why so great.
The Gorilla Comme des Garçons store is at 125 West 4th Street in Los Angeles. But it's not the only temporary visitor in town. Next month, the New York Nonprofit Gallery, Storefront for Art and Architecture, will touch down on Sunset. Joseph Griemer is the new director and says he wanted to infuse some fresh ideas.
I was looking for a way to spread the work that we do into beyond the realm of the limits of New York. And this mainly because I wanted to establish some kind of an interurban dialogue. And we decided to start with Los Angeles because it seems to us that there's an incredible wealth of architectural culture here.
But you're not planning to stick around. You're coming in the beginning of April and then, I think, going 6 weeks later. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Maybe even less, 5 weeks later. It's a flash. We're going to inject a little bit of the energy that we've been kind of injecting into the space in New York and then disappearing again. And it's an experiment.
So is it any coincidence that you and Comme des Garçons are here at the same time?
Well, it's actually, to be completely honest, I was very much inspired by what Comme des Garçons are doing. I really like their model of kind of visiting cities for a short period of time. So I really thought that's a fantastic model. Why don't we try and do something like that with a non-profit? Why don't we try and copy their model? Why don't we see if it works in a completely different field?
Storefront will be at Paper Chase Printing at 7176 Sunset Boulevard. It's going to host a fascinating exhibit of Russian architecture in the last two decades of the Soviet Union. The show's called CCCP, in this case, Cosmic Communist Constructions Photographed, and it'll open on Friday, April 11. See our website for more details. So what is it with this pop-up phenomenon? Danielle Carrillos is editor-at-large for DailyCandy.com. That's a website offering a daily tidbit of what's worth knowing about in style and culture. She reviewed the pop-up Comme des Garçons in L.A.
In general, pop-up stores, I mean, if you think about the most basic notion of what a pop-up store is, they go back in time, I don't know, as long as shopping has. The merchant setting up shop outside of the normal, like, storefront space to avoid rent or to test the waters in a new market. But in the past, let's say 5 or 6 years, really popularized by Rei Kawakubo of Comme des Garçons, she really pioneered this idea of using pop-up stores as a marketing tool, as an exciting, you know, buzz-generating thing. Since then, and she's put them in a lot of what they call second cities, like Berlin, Beirut. Not that, of course, L.A. is a second city, but she finds space, she and her team find space that is less expensive, that is unexpected, that is physically and sort of psychologically off the beaten path. So I think this trend is going to continue, and I think you have a great example of it in the Comme des Garçons pop-up store in downtown Los Angeles.
And you've seen a number of these pop-up Comme des Garçons stores, some that preceded the one in L.A. How does this one compare?
Well, I know most specifically the one that was in Berlin a few years ago. And the one in Berlin was, I think, a little more, I don't know, permanent feeling. The one in downtown L.A., I parked the car, and a person who I thought was a hobo told me, "Don't worry about the broken meter. They won't ticket you." And I said, "Okay." And then he said, "Are you looking for the Gorilla store?" through his shaggy beard. And I said, "Yes, yes, I am." And he opened a gate and took me down a long winding, not winding, but a long sort of creepy-seeming alley. And there was Comme des Garçons just off this alley. And it really was, as a jaded New Yorker, I don't get frightened in urban situations very often, but this was one setting where I was a little bit put off. I was like, what if he shuts that gate and then, you know, a pack of dogs comes out? And that's really how this most recent Comme des Garçons feels. It is very industrial and much more industrial than the ones I've seen. It is very raw. And I think that they had to do it this way because the notion of a pop-up store is not what it was when they first started doing this. It is not something that is shocking to people anymore. So I think this rugged urban grittiness is to surprise us once more, as they did years ago when they did the first one.
But it's a strange combination because you get there. It is indeed a rough neighbourhood. It is not very far at all from Skid Row, where there are many, many tragically poor people. And then you walk in and you find Rodeo Drive prices, astronomical prices. It's a weird kind of juxtaposition.
It is. And I guess in a negative sense, you could think of it as, I don't even want to say it, but almost like theater for people who spend thousands of dollars on clothing, right? It's a created experience. On the other hand, it is bringing foot traffic to a burgeoning neighborhood downtown Los Angeles. There are cafes and shops of various sorts and of more modest prices and goods springing up down there, and there is a bit of a renaissance. So on the one hand, it is a little bit outrageous, the juxtaposition between what you find inside and what you see on the outside getting there, but it's certainly a development.
Sure. And then it raises, or these pop-up stores in general, raise the interesting question of what it does mean economically to have this kind of minimal impact, to go in, have a sort of blast of activity, get people excited, start to sort of generate a business and an economy surrounding it, and then go. What about that?
It's the most important, or I don't know if important is the right word, but it really is the only thing to talk about when we talk about pop-up stores, because on the one hand, there's nothing more depressing than seeing a store that's time has come and gone, and it lingers as the tenant or the shopkeepers finish out their lease somewhere. And we've all seen a store go out of business horribly with maybe big sales, and it's really depressing, right? So why not set up something whose very essence is temporary, so you never have that downfall? But on the other hand, it is in this ADD culture and society, it's sort of like what we can't even expect a store to last. We're so jaded and we're so, you know, in need of entertainment and excitement that we can only, our store can only hold our interest for 6 weeks or a year. So on either side, I mean, it might be just sort of catering to what shoppers in general like these days, or it might be hastening the ever-shrinking attention span that we as consumers have.
Danielle Kourilos is editor-at-large for Daily Candy. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. Coming up, an assault on the front lawn. And a public art leader chooses her favorite building in Los Angeles.
KCRW supporters include Grove Press, the publisher of About My Life and the Kept Woman, the new memoir from John Retchie, author of City of Night, in bookstores now.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. If you had to pick a defining feature of American suburban life, what would it be? The car, the barbecue, or the shiny green front lawn? Lawn, slurping water and toxic pesticides, carpets the front yards of millions of homes in LA and beyond. But the architect, artist and activist Fritz Haig decided there was better use for that space. He's created Edible Estates, Attack on the Front Lawn, and I spoke to him last week about it.
Edible Estates, Attack on the Front Lawn is the new book that's just coming out chronicling the series of edible estate gardens I've been doing for the last 3 years now, which is simply a series of prototype gardens to replace front lawns with edible landscapes.
And what do you mean by edible landscapes? Do you mean vegetables?
Well, everything that's edible. When I do a garden in any given city, I pr- pretty much plant whatever will grow in that region that produces edible fruits, vegetables, herbs, grains, really anything.
So we're sort of talking kind of victory gardens, but on the front lawn.
Exactly.
And the front lawn in America is sacred and doesn't usually have vegetables planted on it. Not typically. There's obviously people who do very creative things with their front lawns, but your attack is on the unused front lawn.
Right. And in the tradition of our American front lawn as it exists today really isn't all that old. It goes back to the 40s or 50s. Before that, during the war, we did have victory gardens where up to 80% of Americans at one point were growing their own food on their own property during the wars. And that movement dried up almost immediately when the war finished and we had this explosion of suburban developments, which gave rise to the front lawn as we know it today.
And even since the war, in the suburban developments, you'll still find people will grow fruits and vegetables in their backyard, but not in the front yard. What is it about the front yard that makes people grow lawn?
Well, I think there's some sort of unspoken agreement that's handed down from generation to generation lately that says the front lawn is this sort of sacred no man's land that we kind of tend collectively as a society. And there were some early notions of this with Jefferson and even Frederick Law Olmsted about the function of the lawn in a democratic society. But I'm narrowly focused on the front lawn because it's that moment at which the private space of the house meets the public space of the street. And what is currently this no man's land with an edible garden becomes a very social space.
Interesting. Now, there are people out there who are exploring the same terrain as you, and there's certainly people in horticulture who have been promoting ideas about growing one's own food and so on. You have raised this to the level of art. You have these estates as being commissioned by art museums. Why? How did you sort of make that leap?
I don't know. I think my work has evolved in the art world. That's where it's come from. And I think it's an interesting distinction, but I like to, as much as possible, straddle things as much as I can. So as an art project, I'm really interested in these gardens as revealing something about how we live today, telling stories about how we relate to our environment and our cities and our communities by making these gardens.
So it's garden as commentary. It's not that it has a sort of a particular visual dimension to it that is artistic in exploration.
Well, there's that too. I mean, my background is in architecture, so I take the design of each garden seriously. I'll sit down with the family and we'll develop a design based on their desires and their needs and that particular piece of land and how to respond to it in terms of making spaces for people as well. But once the garden's planted, it really becomes the project of the family, and it's turned over to them. So over time, the garden may change radically from what it originally was. You know, it's not like a building where you design it, make it, and that's it. The garden has much more potential to evolve and change radically over time.
In the garden of fruitfulness, you plant and it grows. Yeah.
Fritz Haig has planted gardens in Kansas, in New Jersey, and Lakewood, California, and has one underway in Austin, Texas, and at Descanso Gardens in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. You can meet him at a happening at Mocha at the PDC on Saturday afternoon, March 29. He'll sign copies of Edible Estates, Attack on the Front Lawn, and will host a jam-making session. And that's jam in jars, not the music. See our website for more details. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA, Design and Architecture, on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. And finally, for our favourite building in Los Angeles, Julie Silliman is Director of Civic Art for the Los Angeles County Arts Commission. She chose the LA Central Library in downtown.
Well, I have such fond memories of a certain time in my childhood when we would take long journeys from the very edges of the San Fernando Valley suburbs, and a parent in the neighborhood would load a bunch of children into a station wagon and take the long journey down to the Central Library, where we would spend a considerable amount of the day lingering in the children's reading area with these wonderful Ivanhoe murals surrounding us.
But then in your adult time, if just a few years ago, the Central Library went through a major overhaul. And how do you feel about it now?
Well, it sadly in the mid-80s suffered severe damage through fire, and then that created an opportunity to restore the old library and expand it. And I came back to Los Angeles and found myself working for the redevelopment agency that was partially financing the library, so I had an opportunity to see it go inside while it was under construction and see how the walls of the library were created, hollow terracotta brick. And then in 1993, attend a very wonderfully celebrated public openings and enter the library, and tears absolutely came to my eyes. It was just so wonderful to see us being able to use this library again. And then I have frequently talked about the library because it's a fine example of collaboration in public buildings, in that when Bertrand Goodhue was designing the library, he brought to the table with him before he started to design the library the artist Lee Lowry, and a philosopher, Hartley Alexander, whom he had met when he was working on the Nebraska State Capitol. And together they kind of themed the library and found ways to incorporate art in almost every surface. And then in the expansion that happened in the early 90s, public art was again included and included in some very interesting ways. One of my favorite projects is by the artist David Bunn, where he lined one of the elevators that runs through the shaft of the new building with the old library cards, because the library cards was a system that was going out of use at that time because it was going digital. And so the librarians gave him access to the actual old cars, and he lined the cab of the elevator with all of the books that start with the complete guide to. So it might be the complete guide to cake decorating, the complete guide to gardening, the complete guide, you can name it. It's quite funny.
You now have your own children. Would you take your children to the Central Library?
Oh, I'd love to, but sadly, the children's section is no longer in that same section. So the Ivanhoe murals are, in fact, in the international languages section. And there are California history murals in this children's section, which I think is larger than it used to be. But yes, it has marvelous spaces that you can spend a lot of time in.
That was Julie Silliman, Director of Civic Art for the Los Angeles County Arts Commission. The Los Angeles Central Library is at 630 West 5th Street. You can find out about goings-on in design and architecture in LA on our website, but I should mention one must-see installation at SIARC in downtown, opening on March 28. It's by a very talented designer called Elena Manfredini, and her project, Merletti Interlace, marries 21st century technology to the ancient craft of lace-making. And last but absolutely not least, I want to mark the passing of one of LA's unique spirits, Nader Khalili. Nader was an architect who devoted himself to designing affordable and emergency housing using earth construction techniques inspired by the ancient structures of his native Iran. He created a foundation in Hesperia called Cal Earth. He taught many students, and he also translated poetry by the Iranian poet Rumi, which he often connected to his work with the four elements, earth, water, air, and fire. Nader passed away on March 5th at the age of 72. A memorial will be held at Cal Earth on March 29. That's it for this month's DNA. Thank you very much for listening. The show was produced by Ray Guana, with production assistance from Melissa Walker. The consulting producer is Jennifer Ferrow. Thanks to Nan Sherry Lieberman for managing the website. You can listen to today's or past shows anytime by going to kcrw.com/DNA. And you can also podcast the show from there or from iTunes. I'm Frances Anderton. Join me next month for more DNA.